Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection. Science and reason were integral in the formation and birth of America and democracy. However, on further consideration, it's been noted that our founding principles of freedom and equality are often in tension. Could they be problematic in our attempts at healthcare reform? Welcome to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Timothy Ferris. He's the author of the recent book, The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. He has been called the best popular science writer in the English language today, which puts him in the heady atmosphere of the late Carl Sagan and Stephen Jay Gould. He's written a dozen books, having received nominations for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. He's produced three documentaries, each of which premiered on PBS. And he also produced the photograph record that is now aboard the Voyager spacecraft, which are leaving or have left our solar system. So it's with really great pleasure that I welcome Mr. Ferris to Line 1. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good to see you. Hear you, rather. How are you?
I am great, and it's, like I said, a great pleasure. Science often starts with some definitions, and those who listen to my program often know I start that way. I want to define some terms that we'll talk about related to your book. What's science, and what do you mean by liberalism? Let's start with those.
Those are two very good points, I think, because often people do mean different things by those words. I use the word science to mean what we call modern science, which is science as we know it today, a professional operation, largely professional, that is integrated into society with universities, laboratories, refereed journals, conferences, and all of that. That dates back to the mid to late 1600s, so we've had 300 to 400 years of science, which is relatively short compared to other intellectual activities. And by liberalism, I mean the classic liberalism, the one that I would maintain is the only one that should be called by that term. It's an independent political philosophy, has nothing to do with the left or right, and it was the basis of the founding of this country. And a liberalism is simply a political philosophy that posits, like a scientific idea, that a government could work better and as well as be more just and fair if the people choose their own leaders. The term liberal democracy means a democracy that respects human rights. It's, in other words, you get to vote on everything except taking away, you can't vote to take away your next-door neighbor's human rights. And that form of government, liberal democracy, has gone from a tiny fraction of the world's population just a century or two ago to 47% today. 47% of people alive today live in democratic societies, which is an astonishing and very promising development.
I want to ask about the definition of science. I would have used it as a way of knowing the testable, the way of looking at the natural world that we can and things we can test. Are we different in our thoughts, or is that what you're also saying?
Yes. Prior to the rise of science, there were only two ways to test the validity of a new idea, as Aristotle pointed out 2,000 years ago. One was to test its internal logic. Does it contradict itself? And the other was to compare it to other ideas. Science introduced a third method, which is that when you have a new idea, you test it through controlled experiments. And based on the results, you either reject it or modify it, or you might accept the idea conditionally, provisionally, because you know that another experiment might show up a weakness in it. So the knowledge that science produces is the most accurate and the most probing, really, and deep by far that anyone's ever been able to come up with as a method of interrogating nature. But it has this interesting characteristic that it's always a little bit provisional, and it always admits that it might be wrong. And this leads some folks who aren't familiar with science to think that they can somehow just dismiss it in favor of something that's absolutely certain. Absolute certainty, on the other hand, is an illusion, and it's one that's caused a lot of harm in this world. So I think science, by virtue of its, it has this curious combination of being provisional and yet being very powerful, has been a real step forward in bringing human thought toward a more into accord with the way things really are.
All right. I'm going to give out our contact numbers today and email address if people want to call. I'm doing that somewhat reluctantly because I'm very jealous of the opportunity to just have the whole time to myself. In Anchorage, if you've got questions or comments about today's program, call 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can reach me at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. To get to your book a little bit, I think I'll do it in this way. You said that, or I would say that much of the effort of science is often trying to get to the best understanding of something that's testable, and that often gets to teasing out, as I put it down, the coincidence from causal relationships. Sometimes that gets confused. Is it a coincidence, or is there somehow a causal relationship that democracy and science kind of came upon humanity in a similar time?
Well, it's a good question. Everyone agrees that democracy arose out of the Enlightenment, which is the term used for these all these new ideas that started showing up in the 17th into the 18th centuries. But as to the cause of the Enlightenment, things have gotten much, if you look in the books, it's a lot hazier. And about 20 years ago, I got interested in this question because I'm interested in science, and in the course of many years of research, it seemed increasingly clear to me that the thing that had really sparked or even caused, may not be too strong a word, the Enlightenment, was the discovery of science. The Enlightenment is often portrayed as a battle between reason and superstition, and it, to some degree it was that. But reason on its own is not sufficient to explain the Enlightenment. After all, reason had been around for thousands of years. What science did was to show a method of applying reason to investigating nature that produced much better results than just thinking logically had been able to do before. So what I argue in The Science of Liberty is that it was science that was responsible, the discovery of science responsible for the fact that we had an Enlightenment and we live in a largely democratic world today. Now, that could just be a coincidence, as many people have thought, and there are many other arguments for what caused the Enlightenment. And the purpose of the book is, you know, I don't imagine that everyone in the world will suddenly drop their previous opinions and fall into lockstep with mine, but the purpose of the book was to introduce this idea into the discussion and to make it a respectable argument as I think it ought to be. It's sort of amazing that this is the first book ever written to make this claim, and I think that's we can do better than that.
Yeah, I was kind of it's always interesting to find new ideas, and I have down written that. And although in your book you allude to previous authors who've discussed some relationship between democracy and freedom and science, this might be, at least in your opinion, one of the ones that has really kind of tried to hone down this tight relationship between the development of a democracy with the idea of testing things. And
what I think got us a bit confused was that coming into the 20th century, people were starting to say, "Gee, there looks to be a relationship between free societies, which will have human rights, and scientific progress. All the great scientific work to date has been done in these relatively free democratic societies." But then the disaster, the two world wars followed by the Cold War, created a disillusionment. And a lot of folks felt that the promise of science and liberal democracy had been betrayed somehow. And they also felt, because there was so much propaganda put out on the part of these totalitarian systems, that the Nazi Germany must be a scientific powerhouse and the Soviet Union and so forth. We now know better. We know enough about those regimes to realize that this was largely just public relations. Germany, after all, was a scientific society when Hitler took it over, and although he had a destructive effect on it, it did have a certain amount of momentum. So part of the effort that I had to make in The Science of Liberty was to go back and evaluate these claims and see if see where we got led astray on this. And science is not, in my view, a neutral weapon like a rifle dropped on a battlefield that you can pick up from either side and use. The history, the record of history, is very clear that science has thrived in free societies, not in totalitarian societies. And so I can, and I can even make a prediction on this basis, which is that the Chinese Communist government is now spending increasing amounts of money on scientific research in order to make China a world power in science. And the Chinese people certainly deserve to be a world power in science. They have terrific intellectual capability, and we all look forward to the contributions they can make to science. But I predict that until China is free, it will not become a world-class scientific power.
And your point is to me, as I read it, was that without that intellectual freedom, that science can't advance as it should. It may be stifled because some ruler, somebody, some preconceived ideology says that things should be one way, and that stifles the freedom of thought, which is really all a lot about what science is all
for. Yes, it throttles education. It punishes dissidents, and science is all about, you know, we're pretty ignorant, we human beings. There's just a ton that we don't know about nature. The greatest discovery of science, as Lewis Thomas used to say, is the dimensions of our own ignorance. If you have a free society, then you can adapt to those things. You can say, "Oh, yeah, that's okay." You know, so now we've discovered something we didn't know before. That's cool. But in a totalitarian society, everyone is brought up with certain unassailable myths. Extreme example is North Korea. You can be put in jail for the rest of your life if you don't accept that the beloved, dear leader of North Korea is not only the smartest man in the world, but the greatest golfer, the composer of over 100 operas, the coach of all their athletes. These things seem absurd, but the problem is that when you insist on total control over your people, you must then imagine, you must then persuade them that you have some right to that kind of control. And in that mindset, it's very difficult to get anywhere with scientific research. So, so it's a fortunate thing that freedom has come to pass in part, at least part of the world, and hopefully in the rest to come. In part because it makes possible the ongoing progress of science and the tremendous good that has done. You know, it's an amazing. An amazing thing. When the greatest reductions of poverty, ignorance, hunger, to have taken place in all of history have happened in the past half century. 80% of the adults worldwide can now read and write. That, you know, in 1700, the greatest scientific optimist in the world wouldn't have made a claim like that. That would have seemed just unattainable, and yet here we are.
Yeah, and you point out in the book, and others have, that it's science that's enabled us to feed this explosive growth in the population, and whether that's going to be able to sustain itself is a. But Malthus appears to have been wrong, as you point out, mainly because he didn't maybe anticipate the power of science to figure out ways to solve some of our problems.
To feed people, and now looks as if we will be able to sustain the human population indefinitely into the future. And the reason is because the growth rate is going down.
Right. Right.
And the growth rate is going down because people are moving into cities. And that's what happened in the West, Western Europe, and before. It's happening now in the rest of the world. So we have put a lot of strain on the environment. There are a lot of concerns that are legitimate. But we have a real opportunity here to chart a future that'll be amicable both to our own species and to the rest of the world.
All right. We've got a couple of callers, Mr. Ferris. I'm going to take one of them now. Steve, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I want to call and talk about the science of human personality theory, because I believe we have like 6 million people in the world now. And
billion.
Human personality theory has become one of the most determinant factors, you know, in the course of the planet. And you know, there's different personality theories, and I guess people have said, well, they've never been testable. But increasingly, there's like a body of scientific evidence that is pointing, based on my readings, that actually selfishness is the most prominent human personality characteristic. And there's various psychology terms for it. There's one personality theory that calls that narcissism in a broader sense that would include tribalism, religiosity, and politics. And that's why increasingly in America, actually, American society, of course, according to the test, is becoming more and more narcissistic. And I think it has something to do with the media and like these. And the media has learned how to manipulate us and pander to our weaknesses. And the human brain is actually adaptive. And so we find this trend of American society becoming, and there's various dopamine mechanisms and stuff, but American society is becoming more narcissistic. That's why people can totally disagree on things like the presence of God or evolution or global warming, because essentially they're going to take a selfish perspective, a selfish bias. And I think personality theory is what's driving the world right now.
Well, I'm not in a position to say anything about personality theory, but I would remark on a difference between liberal democracy and other forms of government. What many of the thinkers in the Enlightenment made the mistake, and the horrors of the French Revolution were a result of this mistake, of thinking that to make the world a better place, it was necessary to make people better people. That and this is a strain that continues in American thought today, that the only way, you often read, for instance, that by environmental writers, that our only hope for saving the environment is to have some fundamental change in human personality. That, to me, is just another way of saying it's not going to happen. Because people aren't going to change. But the beauty of democracy is that it doesn't require people to change. It doesn't require people to be selfless or selfish or smarter or dumber. It works regardless. It's better for a country to be educated, of course, and that's why we spend so much money on education in the United States. The United States spends more per pupil on public education than any major nation in the world. And other countries, as they get some money, they tend to invest in education as well, many of them, for just that reason. So I'm skeptical of theories that say that we're in trouble because, you know, we're getting more selfish. And I also look for empirical information. If, for instance, Americans are more selfish than they were a generation ago or 100 years ago, you would expect the portion of their wealth that they contribute to charity, let's say, to have gone down, right? Because they're more selfish, they don't care about other people. But the opposite is happening. Americans become more generous over time rather than less. So I don't pretend to understand personality theory, but those questions do occur to me.
Okay. Let's take another caller. Anna, you're on line one.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I had a question about the growing... I wanted to know what you guys thought about the future of democracy with the growing anti... or the kind of the resistance of science in the United States. I'll take my...
Yeah, so the question is the apparent resistance and anti-science philosophy dangerous to the future of democracy in the United States? Is that...
Well, to the degree, yes. And thank you for that question. I think it's a really good question. I don't know... You know, if there is growing hostility towards science, there certainly is a lot of it. Almost half of Americans say that on certain key points, such as biological evolution, they prefer to believe something based on a religious text than the scientific information. I don't want to say those attitudes represent a direct danger to democracy, but if, as I argue, science is really at the center of the culture of democracies, then if you got a profoundly anti-scientific sentiment, you would have an anti-democratic one as well. And it is interesting to me that many of the opponents of science that one finds around the world, particularly, you know, in intellectual life where they write books and make their positions very clear, are also opponents of liberal democracy. So I think your question is well-founded. Yeah, those two do kind of rise and fall together.
Along the same line, I guess, is a question I had written down, and I want to refer somewhat back to Carl Sagan and skeptical thinking, which I'm going to define skeptical thinking, but I think they're very similar to the scientific method. But, you know, he says that the skeptical thinking means that the ability to construct and understand a reasoned argument and to therefore recognize fallacious or fraudulent arguments. And he provides in one of his more popular books, a baloney detection kit, and implores us to understand logical fallacies as a way of thinking. Given that idea, it seems like it would behoove countries to really help their populace think scientifically or reasonably so that they might choose the right courses and the right leaders. Am I going way out there, or does that fit with Anna's discussion or question a little bit?
Well, a wise host or hostess planning a dinner party will, the two subjects they always discourage at the dinner table are politics and religion. And if you ask why is that, the reason is because most of us acquired our politics and our religion, our political and religious beliefs, before we were old enough to be skeptical, to be reasonable. We absorbed them as articles of faith. And so consequently, we have this weird combination of a deep belief in something with a tendency to get defensive and argumentative if anyone questions it, because at some level we know that we never really constructed foundations for these things. They were just what was handed down to us. Most people have the same politics that their parents had and the same religious opinions. So one way to define education is that you finally, you know, you leave home, you go to college, hopefully, and you finally examine all these views in the light of the evidence and try to form a grown-up understanding of the world that you've constructed for yourself out of facts and reasoning. And that, to me, is what education is about. Unfortunately, a lot of times those opportunities are missed. People go to get educated and they just learn a trade, let's say, or they just absorb another ideology, because there are a lot of ideologies floating around in colleges. And, when I was an undergraduate, for instance, everyone was reading Heidegger. To be considered an intellectual, you had to read Heidegger's Being and Time, an almost incomprehensible work by a man who was an opponent of both science and democracy, and who, despite his own denials, is now very clearly understood to have been an enthusiastic Nazi. So I pointed this out in my book, and I got angry letters from people who still think that Heidegger has something to teach us about democracy. You know, at some point, to be educated, you really have to say, gee, no matter what was inculcated in me earlier, this doesn't make so much sense. You know, I can do better than that. And that individual position, taking responsibility for your opinions based upon your own investigations rather than just what somebody else told you, is what it means to me to be an educated person.
Well, that's what brought science around. It's when people started questioning what they were being told and really testing it.
Yeah, I mean, prior to the rise of science, if you went to medical school, you were being taught from textbooks that were centuries old.
Right.
And the law prohibited you. In Italy, you couldn't dissect a corpse. Mm-hmm. To find out whether, you know, your anatomy book was right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get very far that way.
You know, I don't know. There's been a lot of thoughts going around here, but one of them that came to my mind real quickly was you're so good about describing the historical personages of Franklin and Thomas Paine and Jefferson and Washington. And to me, those are guys who were brought up in that time where slavery was a given in an understanding. And each of those guys, I don't think maybe it's necessarily Paine, but Franklin, Jefferson, and Washington all had to come to grips with that idea. And they all, as I understand it, saw that that was not correct. It took a while to make those changes in their livelihood. But, I mean, that, again, is that open-mindedness, that willingness to question what you're being told or what you have been told, even by very important people, and analyze it.
This was a deep source of anguish to Jefferson and Washington, who were both slave owners, Virginia plantation guys who've been born into that system. And they wrestled with it, and they wrote a lot about it. And, you know, one can criticize them for not doing this or that, and many books have been written doing just that, but you can't just call them hypocrites, because they weren't. They understood that there was they were in a society that was entangled with the vestiges of the past. In the end, 500,000 Americans were killed on the battlefield to bring that hideous institution to an end. So they were, I think, quite right to say there wasn't something that could be done easily or by the stroke of a pen.
One more thing I've got to do that I regret to do today is I've got to take a short break, so we're going to be back in just a minute. I want to remind you you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. After this short break, we'll continue to discuss these issues with and his book, The Science of Liberty, with Timothy Ferris. This is Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Timothy Ferris, who's author of The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. You may email your questions or comments to line1@kska.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 locally, then it's a recorded broadcast, and you won't be able to contact us about questions. Mr. Ferris, there is an email that I've gotten similar to a question that Anna had written, had called in earlier. She writes, this writer writes, it appears that there is currently a great deal of distrust in science and scientists in America. In your opinion, what is the basis of this distrust? Is there a connection for the fact that we live in a republic, or could it be that scientists are now saying things, particularly such as related to climate science, that people just don't want to hear?
Well, there certainly are, you know, the climate change stuff is sort of an unwelcome message, although it was inevitable, and in some degree it's happened before. We had issues with ozone depletion and with acid rain that had to be addressed, and those were unwelcome findings, too. Global warming is bigger and more significant. I think the reason people fear and distrust science to the extent that they do is because they don't understand it. If you have failed to understand what science is or how it works, and you realize that it's powerful, then you may react negatively to it. And I've seen a lot of this with the with climate science, the so-called climate gate. Scandal, which was not a scandal at all. There's really just nothing to it, but has been seized upon by opponents of science all over the world to indicate that there's, you know, they're being sold some sort of ideological agenda. So let me again say that one of the beauty of science, like democracy, is that it doesn't require some superior form of humans to be doing the work in order to get good results. Nothing in my book or in arguments about science generally requires scientists to be any better than the rest of us. They make mistakes just like anyone else. But science is a self-correcting system, and the mistakes will get ironed out. Evidence about greenhouse gases and the warming of the Earth goes back over 150 years for hundreds of different researchers in many different countries. And to imagine that all these people were involved in some sort of conspiracy to push some political agenda is just ignorant. So my short answer to your question is the hostility from science comes from the same reaction you'll get any other time, that if you see something impinging on your life and it's powerful but you don't understand how it works, then you tend to be fearful and suspicious of it.
Is there a innate from the birth of our nation distrust of government and big social?
Well, yeah, all liberal democracies have a problem, and it is that the size of government is growing in every single one of them as a share of GDP, of the gross domestic product of that country. In other words, in all the liberal democracies, the government's taking a little bit bigger share of the economy with each passing decade. And that should be a concern to all Americans, not just one or another vocal group on the fringe. And I think that one way to look at it is the way we were talking about science earlier. Science has a feedback loop. You have an idea, an experimental test, and then an evaluation. A liberal democracy is an experimental system. Every election is an experiment, every piece of legislation. So we're pretty good at coming up with ideas, and we're pretty good at running experiments, but we haven't been so good at evaluating them and getting rid of the things that don't work, because there are a lot of projects, a lot of programs that don't work very well, but they have a constituency. And, you know, after all, I made a film recently that was funded in part by government money, so, you know, I like that program. So there are always people that say, oh, don't cut this. But you have to have some method, and what I seems to me might be better in this country and some of the others democracies would be if we had an independent standing commission to evaluate programs and produce reports maybe on an annual basis as to how things are working, to make it a little harder for Congress to keep always approving these kind of pork barrel things, we might be able to improve the evaluation process that way. So I don't think it has to be viewed in terms of a suspicion or hostility toward government. It's just that no matter what your politics are, there has to be some point, unless you're just, you know, a flat-out Marxist, there has to be some point at which you say, that's really enough. You know, the government shouldn't get any bigger than that. We've seen that already in Scandinavia, where the government's got to where they're confiscating almost half the GDP. And those countries began to back off at that point. And I think we're kind of at that point in this country. That said, it really is unfair to attack the Obama administration for big spending. You know, as everyone knows, that spending was primarily necessary because of a hideous recession. It's temporary. A lot of it's already been paid back. So it's really just stump rhetoric to stand up and pretend that, you know, Obama's trying to undertake some vast increase in the size of the federal government. That's really not borne out by the facts. Hmm.
A lot of medicine has to be shown to be safe and effective before it can be given. Maybe we should require that for legislation. John, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. First-time caller, long-time listener. And a big fan of Timothy Ferris. I was just wondering if, because I have his DVD, The Creation of the Universe.
Yes.
Which was I just
a long time ago.
For me, it's right up there with Carl Sagan's Cosmos. You know, it's not in 12 parts, but it's just as potent. I was wondering if you had what your next project might be as far as something scientific in a DVD like that.
Well, there are two other films. There's one called Life Beyond Earth and another one called Seeing in the Dark about stargazing. And it would be nice if a film were made of Science of Liberty, because I think there are a lot of interesting talking points.
Yeah.
But I'm probably not going to make that film myself. I'd probably encourage someone else to make it, because I wouldn't want it to appear that I was, you know, pushing a particular argument myself. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your kind words on that. I appreciate that.
Oh,
the creation of the universe is so old that some people think it was came out around the same time as the creation of the universe.
Well, no, I've never had anyone explain to me the natural forces of the universe so, I guess, easily. I watched the creation of the universe maybe 100 times to really get into it and to maybe understand most of it, because it is a lot. For that specific notion, you know, the forces of the universe, that was never really explained to me. And, you know, and the visuals of the film was really good, too. It's just, I think it's a really good catch. I think that was one of the greatest documentaries out there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your saying that you've seen it repeatedly, because we made it to be... The first thing I said at the first production meeting of that film was that, think of this like a record. You know, it's something... It's not TV. It's something that if you buy a record, you expect to play it more than once. And
exactly.
We can't explain this stuff in a way that everyone will get it in one viewing, but if we do a good job, maybe people will come back. And so I'm very gratified to hear that you have watched it a few times.
Thanks for your call.
Hundreds, a few, I guess.
Thanks for your call, John.
Yeah, bye-bye.
I want to get back a little bit to your book, because of the historical perspective and the issues on science. And one way to do that would get you to talk a little bit about some of the characters. In particular, I'd like you to talk about Payne. He's the guy I learned the most about, how he relates to democracy and how he relates to science and the formation of our country.
Tom Payne grew up in an obscure village in poor village in England, and didn't show much promise. He was thought to be sort of a dull boy. He was going to be an apprentice to his father's stay-making plant, and he managed to escape. He ran off to war, and was on a ship that captured a French ship, and in those days, all the crew got a share of the spoils, and with his share, he was able to go and live in London for a year. And there he learned about science, and he got fascinated by science and was able to meet Ben Franklin, who was in London at the time, and get a letter of introduction, and came over to the U.S., had to be carried off the boat because he came down with typhoid on the long voyage, and started writing a series of books that just made it so clear to Americans that their future was or could be to be a free country. And he was Tom Paine who named the country. The United States of America is a coinage of Tom Paine's. He was primarily a science writer. Most of his writing is about science, but he united it with this belief in freedom and democracy. He was wrongly thought to be an atheist, which he was not. He was probably what one would call a deist. But on the strength of the reaction against him that came from religious quarters in this country, there is to this day no statue of Tom Paine in Washington, D.C., which I think is a disgrace, really, and ought to be fixed.
Mm-hmm. To get into a little bit of health care, let me also ask you, what would Paine and Jefferson and Washington and Franklin be saying if they were live today and aware that, you know, of all the developed countries, we're the one that has not seen that we should perhaps be having, I don't want to inject my ideas in here, but I guess I can't help, have a universal health insurance, and that we have 40 million uninsured individuals. We spend twice as much as all of our nearest competitor in health care expenses, and yet we're losing ground in most parameters that measure health care. What's that all about? What would these guys be telling us or thinking? I'm just curious.
Well, it's a good question, and I think Paine would have been pro-universal health care. Thomas Jefferson was more of a states' rights guy and probably would have preferred that it be done on at a state level. But it's a good example of the difference between an ideological stance and an empirical stance. Empirically, meaning fact-based, we look around the world and we see what you said. All the liberal democracies except the United States have universal health care, and it's popular. People don't want to get rid of it. They also get pretty good health results for less money. One of the points that might have been made during our past year-long discussion over this, debate over this prior to the passing of the Act, is that we're already paying for universal health care. Americans are already paying, before that we passed the Obama plan, they were already paying more of their tax dollars for health care per capita than the citizens of those Western European democracies that have universal health care. So the issue is not an ideological one, it seems to me, regardless of whether we have universal health care or we don't. The real issue is these steeply rising costs and how to get them under control. And that, you know, that's not likely to be solved by the current legislation. Likely to be a persistent problem. But I do think that extending health care to millions of people who can't afford it is just a good housekeeping measure for any country. It has a lot of empirical benefits, quite aside from just the question of whether anyone should be morally comfortable in a country in which your infant mortality rate is indexed against one's income. Quite aside from all that, there are a lot of good empirical reasons for freeing people up from the threat of catastrophic health care costs, someone in the family getting sick, and for things like labor mobility. You know, the United States has had a lot of benefits economically from the fact that we have one of the most mobile workforces in the world. It's a big country. We all speak pretty much the same language. It's easy to go from state to state, and so people do. But the existing healthcare system, which was keyed to an old kind of Rust Belt industry thing where you got your healthcare along with your employment, was hurting that because people were afraid to leave their jobs and try something new because they would lose their healthcare. And to address that just seems to me to be a very, very simple and uncontroversial issue.
Another way to perhaps draw back to your book and references is to point out that one of the great public health successes in the history of civilization has been immunizations, and yet there is a tremendous underlying concern and distrust, which seems to come back to the journalistic integrity to some degree that you point out that Jefferson fought so much and yet was such a staunch defender of the freedom of speech. Perhaps you can try to draw these two things together as I am.
Well, Jefferson and Franklin and other founders vaccinated members of their own family and themselves against smallpox. Smallpox, you know, prior to the vaccine was so common that in the way bills, the billboards for advertising for the return of runaway slaves, one of the marks of identification was to mention if someone did not have smallpox scars on his face, because the normal situation was that you were scarred by smallpox. Today, we have a very dangerous tendency arising with a kind of new age anti-scientific view of medicine in which people are free riding. That is, they are not vaccinating their children because some guru or some book they read says that maybe they shouldn't. There's no known reason, by the way, that they shouldn't vaccinate their children. And because we've managed to hold so many serious diseases at bay through existing vaccination programs that they can get away with it. They say, well, you know, I've never seen anyone with typhus or smallpox, so I don't need to vaccinate my kid. The tipping point, you're a physician, you could tell me if this is the right number, but I think it's said to be around 40%. You get around 40% of a cohort that's not vaccinated, say kids in a school. You then put everybody at risk. There's a risk of that a lot of those kids are going to get sick and you're going to get epidemics. So I have very little patience with this kind of view that, you know, that it starts with a qualifier. They always talk about Western medicine and, you know, Eastern medicine and the same thing, Western democracy and Western science. There's no such thing. There's only science and democracy. There's no Western style of doing science. And so it's frustrating that people imagine otherwise. And another way to say this is that we live in one world, in one universe. It's all connected. And so one should be suspicious of ideologies that try to divide it up. Say that, you know, there are two kinds of people. You're either with us or you're against us, or that there's two kinds of medicine or any of that. Those things are almost always based on delusions.
Mm-hmm. And Marshall Angell, who was, the first female editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, has put it at saying that there's only really one kind of medicine. That's proven medicine, and then there's unproven medicine, or documented and substantiated and unsubstantiated medicine, which is, I think, what you're saying.
That's right.
Well.
When I was in college, it was quite common to hear people say that the great medical advances were being made by the communists, and that in China you had these barefoot doctors that could cure people through Eastern methods. Mm-hmm. Well, the barefoot doctors were a creation of Mao Zedong because he had promised that they were going to have better medical care. He couldn't deliver on the promise, so he just dispatched lots of what we would call paramedics without much in the way of medicine or equipment and not much education to go out and try to treat people. And then he put out a lot of propaganda to the effect that this showed the superiority of the Marxist system. That background should be a consideration for anyone who, you know, is withholding vaccinations from their children because they think that somehow they distrust what they imagine to be Western medicine. All I ask of those folks is don't take my opinion or anybody's opinion for it. Just look at the facts. There are plenty of facts out there. It's easy enough to find them nowadays. But, you know, ask yourself, do I really care enough about these half-baked beliefs of mine to ignore the facts and the risk of the lives of my children?
Somebody was talking about the science of personality, or the idea of personality, when you were saying that they should look at the facts. We're stuck with this psychological idea of confirmational bias, where we know people don't look at things that don't fit their preconceived notions, and so they don't change their minds.
Well, except that over history, you know, progress is made. Americans are much better educated than they were even just 50 years ago.
Yep.
People, more and more people around the world, and very soon now, the majority of the world's people are going to have access over the internet to the majority of the world's books. That's an astonishing step, which is really difficult to predict. Mm-hmm. what will come of that. So, you know, back once again when I was a kid, I went to a racially segregated public high school in Coral Gables, Florida. And I was told that this is how it would always be, because you couldn't legislate people's morality and they would never change. Well, you go back to that school now, it's been fully integrated for many decades, and there was never any trouble. Those attitudes that were thought to be set in stone are held by almost nobody down there today. So I'm optimistic about people's ability to learn.
You're optimistic because of the discovery of science and the discovery of democracy and people's willingness to govern themselves and is that a better way? Do you see problems that might deter that optimism in any way?
Well, sure. There are always problems, and there we're going to have some big ones ahead. We're facing some problems right now. Just to mention one, nonlinear effects in climate change. When you add another 1% to greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, you don't necessarily just get 1% unfavorable or unpleasant results back. It can jump to 20 or 30 or 40%. The danger with climate change is that if you don't start to move in the right direction, you can run into a runaway situation in which the total economic resources of the world are not sufficient to reverse the problem. And that's a real threat to democracy, because there'll be a push for totalitarian systems to take over. We've even seen one or two environmentalists in the last few months say they would welcome such a change, which I think is a hideously stupid thing to say. So sure, there are a lot of problems. But my point was just that because people haven't learned something yet doesn't mean they won't learn it in the future. 200 years ago, the vast majority of educated men in the Western world thought it was perfectly fine that women couldn't vote, couldn't sign legal contracts, didn't have equal rights. That opinion has gone away, and it went away because it wasn't borne out by the facts. Men voted to give women equal rights. They did that in free countries. It's an astonishing fact. And, you know, before they did it, there were plenty of people saying, oh, they'll never do such a thing. So I that's the basis of my optimism, is just that the record of free countries has been to address lack of freedom. Another example, is gay marriage. This society created, both on the state and federal level, certain economic advantages to being married. Once they were locked into the law, you cannot then deny people of other sexual orientation, other than heterosexual, the right to get married. That issue is just not going to go away. The only choice is either stop supporting marriage, through the government, or open up marriage to people. And we see in states all around the country that the electorate, predominantly heterosexual, in state after state, has agreed with that argument. So liberalism is a very powerful force, because, despite the prejudices or opinions of the past.
Another thing that science does so well, and I want to keep the analogy up with your book and how you proceeded with your arguments, is it debunks myths so well. And you did the same thing, I think, with your historical perspective and really putting some facts down about the totalitarian science, the changes in postmodernism, or what postmodernism was all about, particularly some of the characters involved in that. Is there another myth that we have not discussed so far on this program that might be worth bringing up, in your opinion?
Well, there sure are a lot of them. One of them that I've noticed is that a number of environmentalists, I just was reading a piece yesterday that said this, have claimed that democracies are particularly likely to damage the environment. I guess they have in mind the fact that capitalist countries like the United States and so many others, with their successful economies, use more resources, and that therefore there's some danger. This is a very dubious notion, and it's easy to examine if you just go back and make a list of the greatest polluters of the last 100 years and find out how many of them were free countries. You'll find that they're the top of the list are all totalitarian states: the Soviet Union, Communist China, where people have a voice, where they've got a newspaper that they can call or a broadcast station. They can say, look, there's something wrong down here. People are getting sick. You can send a reporter. They can get word out. The government has to pay attention. Those countries have done better environmentally than have the unfree countries. So there's a kind of ideological bias that comes through in a certain amount of environmental writing that I just think needs to be challenged. When you look at a statement like that just sort of slides past you, it's good to stop and ask, well, is this borne out by the facts? And, the environmental movement has accomplished a lot of things, but it has, I think, been hampered to the extent that it's been identified with a leftist political ideology. Ultimately, environmentalism should be based on science and shouldn't have ideological components at all. Everybody pretty much agrees on what we want. There's not a majority of people who think that if half the species in the world were to go extinct, that would be a good thing, or that the destruction of the beautiful wild lands such as you have there in Alaska would be to everybody's benefit. It's pretty easy to identify general goals that the majority of folks share, and then to look at the facts as to how we can improve matters in those directions. Ideology tends to get in the way of that, and it's important to remember that ideology is a mechanism that came about because of an absence of facts. It's a substitution of a belief system, and it tends to work best when you don't have enough facts. When you do have enough facts, you should be able to transcend it.
Got about 2 minutes, and I want to keep the analogy with science in our formation of our country together as maybe on the last question, and ask you in what ways is science related and integral to our Declaration of Independence and Constitution?
Well, the Declaration of Independence was constructed as a scientific syllogism, and I write about this in the Science of Liberty. And I show how the language used and the way the arguments were constructed came out of Euclid's geometry and some of the Scottish Enlightenment thinkers and teachers who had such a strong influence on the American founders. The way I would put it is that the way Isaiah Berlin put it years ago, that science is at the center of our culture. And I know there are other folks contending for that same flag. There are religious believers who would have you believe, you know, that the United States is religiously based, and there are a lot of different opinions about it. My argument is that is science, and I invite folks to read The Science of Liberty and let me know what do you think about this argument.
You don't know where you're going next, huh? You're looking for something to do?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple of films, but at the moment I haven't taken on a new book. Books are an exhausting business. I've written 12 of them, and I'm not eager to dive back into that boiling pool of oil just yet.
Well, I want to take just a second to say how thankful we are that you took the time with us today. And I should mention that you really have the expertise. You've taught, I think, in history, philosophy, journalism, English, and something else, history, right?
And
you're an emeritus professor of journalism at Berkeley at this time. So thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mr. Ferris, have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
We're going to be back next week. I was asked by one of our listeners to discuss some facts and myths again, this time regarding vitamins, supplements, energy drinks, diet medications, dieting, and so forth. And we'll be doing that with a PhD nutritionist and political activist in nutrition, Dr. Marion Nissel. She's from New York University. It actually won't be next week. It'll be 2 weeks. I think the date will be June 7th. So please plan on being with us at that time. Kristen Spack, who engineered today's program, has put links to Mr. Ferris's documentaries on our website. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.